Good morning, everyone. It's Alan Norris here. Thanks very much for joining us today for Brookfield Residential's third quarter conference call. On the call with me today are Craig Laurie, our Chief Financial Officer, and Linda Northwood, Director of Investor Relations. I will provide some comments on the current market conditions and strategy going forward. Craig will then provide financial highlights of our operations and the financial results. I'd also like to remind you at this time, in responding to questions and in talking about our new initiatives and our financial and operating performance, we may make forward-looking statements. These statements are subject to known and unknown risks, and future results may differ materially. For further information for investors, I would encourage you to review our supplemental information package, which is available on our website. I thought I'd share some thoughts on our performance, the markets, and also positioning us for future opportunities. These comments are also reflected in my letter to shareholders, which was posted on our website this morning. Our Canadian operations performed well in the third quarter, which positions us through sales backlog and other lot sales contracts to do even better in the fourth quarter. Our U.S. operations continue to face the same challenges as the rest of our competitors in the marketplace. Our pre-tax income of $81 million for the 9 months ended September 30, 2011, compared with $130 million for the same period in 2010, reflects similar performance to last year from our Canadian operations, lower performance from our U.S. operations, and the introduction of the transactional debt interest resulting from the merger. Volatility and uncertainty in the global marketplace provides a backdrop for a consumer who's understandably nervous, particularly in the U.S. In Alberta, however, 86,000 new jobs were created in the last 9 months, many related to capital projects slated for Northern Alberta. This job creation, given the size of the province, far outpaces almost any other area around the world. Given the normal time lag between job creation and home ownership, this augurs very well for our future in Alberta. The overriding risk to this positive news in Canada is the threat of a double-dip recession in the U.S. There's many different views on the likelihood of this occurring. If it does not occur, we are well positioned, especially in Canada, to take advantage of the jobs that will continue to be created in the energy industry and the resultant home sales. If a double-dip were to occur, we also believe we're well equipped to take advantage of distressed opportunities, predominantly in the U.S., that will inevitably present themselves over the next 12 to 18 months. Speaking of such opportunities, in order to maintain as much optionality as possible and enhance our liquidity in case these opportunities do develop, the company has reached an agreement subject to board approvals to amend the terms of its $265 million of transaction debt such that the originally scheduled principal payments of $50 million each of the next 3 years will now all be due, along with the final payment of $115 million on December 31, 2015. Further, the company has reached an agreement with Brookfield Asset Management to consolidate its two existing U.S. lines of credit of $225 million into one $300 million line at an interest rate of LIBOR plus 4.5%. We believe that these opportunities provide us with a great deal of flexibility to take advantage of opportunities over the next period of time in anticipation of a U.S. housing recovery. Unlike other publicly traded land and housing companies in the U.S., our common shares are trading at a substantial discount to our book value, a disconnect in the marketplace that we believe overlooks a number of key competitive advantages. 50% of our assets are in strong Canadian markets, which are extremely profitable. Our strategy to control land in markets in the U.S. and Canada that have barriers to entry or have a history of housing demand, and then add value through the entitlement and development process. This also places the company in a strong position when U.S. markets rebound. We have a strong balance sheet, financial flexibility, and are well positioned for growth. As we look ahead, it is incumbent on management to actively communicate with shareholders and potential shareholders these and other differentiating factors. I'd now like to turn the call over to Craig, who will discuss our financial performance for the quarter ended September 30, 2011.
Thank you, Alan. Good morning, everyone. Overall, the financial results reflected continued strength in the Canadian markets, while challenges remained in the U.S. market. For the 3 months ended September 30, 2011, revenue totaled $228 million compared to $240 million for the same period of 2010 as a result of fewer home closings, partially offset by an increase in lot sales. For the 9 months ended September 30, 2011, revenue totaled $644 million compared to $655 million for the same period in 2010. Land revenues for the 9 months ended September 30, 2011 increased 45% with an increase in average lot selling prices and the non-recurring land margins from the change in business practice for lot sales in Alberta. However, home closings and housing revenue for the 9 months ended September 30, 2011, declined by approximately 30% in comparison to the same period last year. The decline in home closings is largely a result of the reduced backlog entering 2011 in both countries. However, net new orders for the 9 months ended September 30, 2011 were 13% higher compared to the same period in 2010, and for the quarter increased 60%, which will translate into closings in the fourth quarter and a strong backlog base in Canada entering 2012. Included in net income for the 9 months on an after-tax basis is approximately $43 million, and for 3 months, approximately $12 million, reflecting the change in business practice on lot sales in Alberta, which was offset by a decrease in revenue from home closings. Brookfield Residential's net income for the 3 months ended September 30th totaled $19 million, or 19 cents per share, compared to net income of $35 million, or 29 cents per share, for the 3 months ended September 30th, 2010. The decrease is primarily a result of the increase in interest expense of $11 million, with the addition of the notes that were issued to Brookfield Office Properties in connection with the merger. Net loss for the 9 months ended September 30, 2011 was $19 million, or 19 cents per share, compared to net income of $91 million, or 75 cents per share, for the 9 months ended September 30, 2010, primarily reflecting increased interest expense of $25 million and the income tax valuation allowance of $71 million. Turning to our unit activity, the company currently sells from 22 active land communities and 34 active housing communities. From these communities, the company closed 2,339 lots and 767 homes for the 9 months ended September 30, 2011, compared to 1,931 lots and 1,095 homes during the same period in 2010. The company's average selling price of lots delivered for the 9 months ended September 30, 2011 was $153,000 compared to $128,000 during the same period last year, with the increase largely as a result of product mix. The company's average selling price of homes delivered during the first 9 months of 2011 was relatively consistent at $371,000 compared to $373,000 during the same period last year. Net new home orders for the nine months ended September 30, 2011 were 1,226 units, an increase from 1,084 units for the 9 months ended September 30, 2010. These strong orders, particularly in Canada, resulted in a backlog of 813 units with a value of approximately $320 million, or approximately $394,000 per unit. Moving to our balance sheet, as of September 30th, our primary asset, our housing and land inventory, totaled $2.3 billion, or approximately 89% of our total assets, similar to prior quarters and December 31st, 2010. Our land and housing assets include homes completed and under construction, and lots ready for construction, model homes, and land under development. Cash flow used in operating and investing activities totaled $13 million for the 9 months ended. Included in this number was approximately $87 million of acquisitions, split approximately $48 million in Canada and $39 million in the U.S. Thank you for joining us in our third quarter conference call. I will now turn the call back to the operator who will moderate questions.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touch-tone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Anyone who has a question may press star and one at this time. The first question comes from Sean O'Malley of Wedge Capital Management. Please go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. A couple questions. First off, I noticed in the central Eastern U.S. Segment, there were very few closings in the quarter, but there was a big increase in the backlog. Does this reflect some movement of homes that were to be closed in Q2 or in the most recent quarter into the next quarter, or are the increased sales and orders from the additional community, or is there something else going on here?
I would say the bulk of that, Sean, is probably a lot of our Toronto activity. We've had some good sales activity through Q3, and so there's a lot of. Eastern U.S. I apologize, just purely the U.S. one. Sorry, Craig? I'm not quite sure on the.
Yes, so that would be Washington, D.C. And it doesn't really reflect things shifting. It just reflects the increased activity in Q3 in Washington.
Okay, and it looks like there was an additional active community added there. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that is correct.
Okay. And then with respect to the financing, it looks like as of the quarter end, you had $192 million drawn on the line of credit, leaving you with $33 million of availability prior to the amendment. Is that correct?
The Brookside Asset Management line, it was 208 drawn. And,
okay. Okay, so... Okay, so the amendment brings your availability up to around $100 million. Is that about right?
That, in the U.S., that's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned that some of the shifting around as it relates to the financing is to prepare for potential opportunities. Do you see specific opportunities that you're pursuing right now, or are you just getting yourself ready for what you see as a potentially fertile market for opportunities?
Well, as Craig outlined in his report, Sean, we have taken advantage of some opportunities in the U.S. and in Canada, for that matter, but most the distressed opportunities are mostly in the U.S. So far, the bulk of them tend to be shorter term, as I've touched on in previous calls. We just think that there's going to be some other ones. We don't anticipate much of a difference in the marketplace next year versus 2011 at this point, but we do see some pent-up demand being created over time. But we think that there could be some opportunities do present themselves because a lot of companies did go on the premise that 2011 or 2012 was when the recovery was going to take hold, and a lot of, whether it be debt renewals or et cetera, were scheduled for this time and next year. So there could be some element of pressure on some companies, maybe some of the privates, where they may be looking to sell off some of their assets. So we're hopeful we can find some of the longer-term opportunities next year, and we just wanted to be ready and able to deal with it.
Okay, great. And then my last question is just I'm trying to get a little bit better understanding on how the financial statements work here. It looks like in the quarter on the balance sheet that your debt fell by about $72 million. Yet, looking at the quarterly cash flow, it looks like you had proceeds from debt of about $8 million. Is there something unusual about how debt works its way through the cash flow statement that I'm not understanding here?
Sure, Sean. This is Craig. So just over half our business is in Canada, and so really that change you're talking about was the conversion of the Canadian dollar to the U.S. dollar. And so the notes payable is the place where you'd see the biggest difference. At June 30th, the notes payable were $498, and at September 30th, it went to $457. There was no actual cash movement there. That was all FX. The Canadian dollar for most of last year has been above parity with the U.S. dollar, but for some reason, within about the last week of September 30th, it dropped below parity.
Got it. I see it now on the comprehensive income. Okay, great. That's all I had. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Alex Avery of CIBC. Please go ahead.
Just on the deferral of those $50 million payments, I guess they'll just continue to accrue interest at about 6.5%, and you would use the proceeds, I guess, in the absence of any other acquisitions, just to pay down your bank lines. Is that a reasonable assumption?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at it on both sides of the – I mean, that's the Canadian side, Alex. And then, as we touched on the previous question, the U.S. Line of credits as well. We really just want to bolster ourselves just in case anything does present itself that we want to take advantage of. There's no question it doesn't change the aggregate of the total debt amount, but it just gives us some more powder to address opportunities in both sides of the border if we want to take advantage.
Okay, and then in your introductory comments, you noted that the job creation in Alberta has been pretty substantial, and that that bodes well for the future in Alberta. Can you just, I guess, give us a little bit more color there as to whether, you know, I guess the housing industry there has been keeping pace with job creation, or if you expect some acceleration from...
Yeah, I mean, I mean the starts are reasonably consistent. I mean, from year to year, there's nothing, it's not sort of jumping through the roof by any stretch, but it's, I mean, prices are holding reasonably well. It is competitive in the housing realm in different pockets, whether it be on the starter side or the move-up side. But what we feel is it augurs very well, just with that job creation tends to have a lag effect before, I mean, rental rates and rental occupancy is very, vacancy is very tight. So I think it augurs well for the future with respect to those jobs being created. And not all of them, I mean, there's a fair bit in Calgary, a fair number in Edmonton, but also a lot up in Northern Alberta as well. So generally speaking, it's just good for the province.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
As a reminder, anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one at this time. The next question comes from Frank Mayer of Vision Capital. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I'm wondering if you could give us some color on the income tax expense of $101 million, which seems to have camouflaged what otherwise would be a very strong year in an earnings sense.
I'll let Craig touch on this, Frank. It's Alan here. We did. There was a deferred tax write-off in Q1, which I'll let Craig expand upon from a U.S. perspective.
Yeah, so as Alan mentioned, we took a valuation allowance in the first quarter against our U.S. Deferred tax asset of $71 million. So if you were to back that out, it would obviously be, I guess, positive $50 million, roughly positive $50 million for the 9 months.
Why was that allowance required?
You're making me go back now to the first quarter, Frank, I have to remember. So in terms of the first quarter, we had a U.S. deferred tax asset of about $70 million. And when the two companies were merged together, you have to look at retroactively whether or not you had positive net income as a merged company. And so over the period of time that you're required to look at, which is about 3 years, we wouldn't have reflected that, and so we were required to take a valuation allowance against that asset.
So does that mean that those losses have now fallen off the table?
No, Frank. There's nothing has changed from the NOLs in the U.S. at all. They still exist, and they're still fully available to us over the 15-year lifespan. It was more of a, I mean, to be blunt, it's more of a technical thing with respect to how the accounting rules are with respect to look back and look forward. And based on the merger, we fell offside with respect to those technical issues. But the losses are still fully available to shelter future taxable income in the United States.
Now, as I understand it, and haven't made it studied this very carefully, but as I understand it, operating losses in the United States are not cannot be offset against operating income in Canada. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you have not found a way to manage that in a constructive way for the shareholders?
Frank, this is Craig. As Alan mentioned, you can't offset since they're two different jurisdictions. You wouldn't necessarily want to migrate the losses into Canada because of the differential in the tax rates. The marginal rate in the U.S. would be somewhere around 38%. The marginal rate in Canada is obviously below 30%.
That's correct. Last but not least, Alan, if I may dwell on your remarks under the headline opportunities in your letter to shareholders.
Yes.
You state you do not believe that we are being appropriately judged in the marketplace for the trading value of our shares. Does this imply that you are going to reveal more information so that the shareholders can more appropriately judge the value of your shares?
Yeah, I think it's incumbent on us, Frank, to we don't compare ourselves with some of the national home builders in the States, and we don't really have many obvious peers in the marketplace because of the North American nature and the somewhat land component. So I think it's incumbent on us to try and come up with as good a form of disclosure so that we can share information with yourselves and others out there as to the metrics of our business, and so that there can be better information out there to understand our business. You've you know the business well because of all the length of time you've looked at our industry. But I think we have to share more information so that there's a better knowledge, because the Alberta business is different than Toronto and is much different than the U.S. So that's
indeed
something we will continue to do.
And is this an initiative something we can expect to see anything substantive in the future? And if so, when in the future?
Yeah, I mean, this year with the merger and everything else, and the deferred tax write-off, it is the numbers are, and the change in business practice in Alberta did give rise to some, to be quite honest, I mean, the financial statements are somewhat confusing as a new startup company there on the merger. So, I mean, obviously, on a go-forward basis, there's going to be much greater clarity on 2012 going forward. So I think it's much easier in order to – there'll be a lot easier to understand on a go-forward basis, and we would be trying to match that up as best we can with the appropriate amount of information so that people can grasp the business and the fundamental metrics.
Now, I've noticed that your parent company has been buying shares. They've increased their stake, if I'm not mistaken, to 73.5%. Why wouldn't you, wouldn't, if you state, as you've indicated in your letter, that the shares are undervalued, why wouldn't the company, instead of using its resources to buy real estate assets in either Canada or the United States, actually buy back the shares itself?
Yeah, that's always an option. Obviously, we're looking at opportunities from the real estate side, and we're looking at the returns we think we can make that. And you would always be measuring one against the other, Frank.
Can you buy real estate as great a discount as you can buy your shares at a discount to what that's really worth?
That's part of the whole decision making process.
Okay, thanks a lot.
The next question comes from Mike Mitchell of Locustwood. Please go ahead.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Guys, great job on the orders. So will a large percentage of those orders close in Q4, or would you expect them to also go into Q1? And then also, could you tell us, what will that mean to your cash flow statement? Will we see the working capital release some cash flow in Q4 and in Q1? Thank you.
Sure, Mike. This is Craig. So on page 10 of the supplemental, we show the split of the backlog. If you were to go down through the split of the 813, much of the backlog in the U.S. will flow through in 11. In Canada, I'd say it's roughly split half and half, where half will flow through in 11 and half will be in 12. In terms of the cash flow, as I mentioned in my remarks, you don't see it on the cash flow statement because if you were looking at investing and operating, it shows a negative 13 between the two. But included in that were over $87 million of acquisitions. In Q4, we still anticipate future acquisitions in the fourth quarter, in both Canada and the U.S. The number is approximately $80 million worth between the two countries. And so I think the number will be still negative in that fourth quarter. But actually, before acquisitions, it's a materially positive number.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, so it'll be an additional $80 million of acquisitions in Q4?
Yes, roughly. We're targeting about $80 million. It's about split between the two countries, 40 in the U.S. and then about 40 in Canada.
So then, for the year, you're looking at about $160 million
of acquisitions.
That's correct.
Yes.
So yeah. Some of them have some VTBs, Mike, as well. Just some vendor take back. So it's not all cash necessarily, but.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Albert Sebastian of Prospect Advisors. Please go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Just on this, on page 12 of the supplemental information, can you give a little bit more granularity in terms of when we look at the entitled lots? Of the entitled lots, what is developed entitled lots and maybe what's underdeveloped in the entitled lot category?
Yeah, typically the way we would, the only time we would actually service and finish some lots would roughly be 9 to 12 to 15 months of future supply. So if you take a look at, say, a Calgary marketplace, Albert, I mean, we might sell somewhere between 1,200 to 1,500 lots a year. So the most that we would ever finish at any one point in time would be somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200, 1,300. And that would be at different stages of finishing. And so in Edmonton, if we do 500 lots a year, 600 lots a year, it would be somewhere around 400 to 600 lots that would be finished or at some stage of finishing. The rest of them remain, albeit they're entitled, they're still in a raw state.
Okay, so when we look at the 50,587 lots,
yes,
that you have that are entitled, is it about 10,000 that are actually developed in saleable lots?
Off the top, I would say it's much less than that.
Much less than that.
But we can clarify that in future supplementals for sure, and we should put that adjacent to that. But it's much less. I mean, in Toronto, I mean, the most it would maybe be 200-300 out of all of that. Northern California, not very many. So I mean, I run down the list, and Alberta is probably the biggest component, and the rest of them would be entitled, but not necessarily in a finished state.
Okay, yeah, I think that would be some good granularity if you could sort of break the entitled down by what's developed, under development, and then maybe just, you know, paper lots.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you can see it with respect to the financial amount on the balance sheet, but what we should do is translate that back into units for you. That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Keith Dalrymple of Dalrymple Finance. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I have a couple of quick questions here. One, can you give me a total liquidity number, cash plus available credit?
Sure. This is Craig. So at September 30th, we don't typically run with cash on the balance sheet. In the U.S., we obviously have the Brookfield Asset Management line. And so if we had cash, we tend to pay that down. As we talked about, it's now increased. So we are 208 drawn. It's now total available of 300. So I guess that's 92. In Canada, we had availability on our borrowing. We have a bank line there, a borrowing base of about $60 million. So I guess in total, that's just over $150 million of, you know, immediately available liquidity. And then, as Mike was talking about, we obviously produce a material amount of cash flow. Before acquisitions, I do believe for the year it'll be over $100 million, but we then have reinvested that into acquisitions.
Okay, excellent. And the changes with the Brookfield entities in terms of the restructuring of the debt and the amended credit line, will that have a significant impact on the interest charges?
Probably balances out, but go ahead.
So the existing Brookfield Asset Management line, there was two lines. One was a LIBOR plus 350, which was an operating line. One was an acquisition line that was put in place a couple of years ago, and it was used for acquisition. So it was a higher rate line. It was at 14%. The new combined rate is LIBOR plus 450. So that's a pretty material improvement there. In terms of the deferral of the $50 million, the current rate was 6.5%. The rate on those payments will now go up to 7.5%. But you get obviously the present value of retaining that capital and being able to invest it for the future.
Okay.
So we think we're a net beneficiary with respect to all of it and in the enhanced liquidity for future opportunities.
Yeah.
Sure, I understood. Okay. And then, you know, I understand how you've been talking about cash flow, how it's used for acquisitions, and that can be a little difficult to discern just from reading the financial statements. If we combine that with the debt that you have due next year, how should we start to think about total cash generation? I recall, if I remember correctly, you had about $550 in total project-related debt due next year. Is that correct? And what are our anticipations around that?
But you really have to dig through that number. You would have had 50, included in the 550. Let's say it would have been $50 million of the the Brookfield office properties that's now been deferred. The remaining $500 million. A lot of that is in the process of being extended right now. So, for instance, the borrowing base, which is, you know, close to $500 million in Canada, is a rotating basis every year. And so it always shows up as maturing, but it continues to rotate forward. In terms of the project-specific debt in the U.S., it's a similar thing where it's usually a term of 1 to 2 years, but it continues to move forward with the project.
As Craig said, I mean, it's been a standard feature for the company, Canadian operations, for decades with respect to how that financial the borrowing base just rolls forward, and you just do regular checks and balances on the asset valuation on the borrowing base calculation, and that debt rolls forward. So it's
okay, great.
Never been an issue.
Great, thank you very much.
Yeah.
The next question comes from David Zellman of Zellman Associates. Please go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. I was hoping to focus a little bit on orders and your current business activity. Can you talk about how your absorptions have been tracking, as well as expectation for community count next year?
This is Craig. I mean, in terms of the U.S., I don't know that I have a specific, really, like, absorption number from the average on each project or anything like that. I think the U.S. continues to move forward, albeit challenged. In terms of Canada,
we've had great activity in our Ontario operations through Q3 and in the Alberta operations. I mean, all in all, I think we're very much on track for similar volumes in Canada from past years. The U.S. continues to be the challenge without question. The absorptions are down, generally speaking, across our four housing operations in the U.S., and it continues to be a challenge with respect to that. So we're taking steps to try and deal with, just make sure we're structurally as efficient as we possibly can given the lower volumes. So, but we can give out offline. We'll get the actual count by community and help you out there, David.
That would be a very helpful. And as well, given the near-term focus of all investors these days, is there anything that can be said about how October, have you seen any sort of rate of improvement relative to some of the slowness we saw throughout the summer?
I think Canada, you know, continued to move forward at a relatively steady pace throughout the year. In terms of the U.S., as you said, I think, you know, particularly in D.C., I'd say we've seen a little bit of a pickup. Same with Southern California. We've seen a little bit of a pickup, certainly from the summertime.
And again, I mean, I think we're going to see a fairly strong, we believe, a good quarter in Canada in Q4, as I outlined in my letter to shareholders as well. So the U.S. is the challenge at this point, but it's something that everybody's facing, and we just have to sort of button it down and make sure that it's in a position so that we can take advantage when we do start to see some light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, you guys are doing a very nice job, and your conservative guidance is much appreciated. That I think if there's a surprise to be had, it may be your U.S. operations might do a little bit better than the commentary you're talking about, but that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
Keep up the good work. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much. We'd love to be in that position when we're next talking to you. Absolutely.
The next question comes from Robert Niewijk of Katana Capital. Please go ahead.
Good morning. This is a really lazy question on my part, but at least it's an easy one. Why is the share count down?
It's from the previous quarter. Not sure. We didn't buy back any shares. I think you're probably looking at it from the diluted point of view.
No, it's basic as well.
Oh, yeah, it's just compared with the April 1. Ask what share deal.
Oh, it's versus last year, you're saying on the last page?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, so the roughly $2 million difference was we set up an escrowed share plan for the executive of 2 million shares, and that's the difference. And so they get excluded from the count.
Okay, thank you.
The next question is a follow-up question from Frank Mayer. Please go ahead.
Given the relatively negative comments that you've been making about the American side of your operations, is there the risk of or the chance of a further write-down of your assets in any part of your operation there?
It's Alan here, Frank. I think our view on, we're going through detailed analysis. We do every quarter on valuations. Many of the assets, if we follow the course of action that we're following on most of our assets, we don't think there's any issue at all. If we decide to change course, which we have no intention at this point on some of the assets, in other words, sell them into a marketplace just now as opposed to waiting and holding and developing through a recovery, I think all in all, we're in decent shape. But there are occasions when something presents itself and we may decide to sell something and redeploy cash. It depends on an asset-by-asset basis, but we're comfortable at this point.
Thank you.
There are no more questions at this time. I will now turn the call back over to Alan Norris for concluding remarks.
Thank you very much, operator. Thanks very much to everybody for calling in, and we'll hope to hear from you at our next one at the year end in February. So thank you very much indeed.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect your lines. Thank you for participating and have a pleasant day.